is The Unseen. And I'm your host, Mike Cleland. Red Pill Junkie is a blogger, artist, and a strong voice within the UFO community. Now, Red Pill Junkie, or RPJ for short, is a pen name, and he writes for The Daily Grail as well as Radio Misterioso. And, like myself, he is a cartoonist. And also, he wrote the foreword to my most recent book, Hidden Experience. And I will be including an audio reading from that wonderful essay at the very end of this episode. RPJ lives in Mexico City, and he has a glorious voice. And please know, I did not add any extra bass during the mix. That's really how he sounds. This interview went a little bit long, so let's not waste any time here. Let's jump right into it. This conversation was recorded Tuesday, May 26th, 2020. Please enjoy. Red Pill Junkie, I am so honored that you said yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Mike. It means a lot to me too. You know, I mean, like, I've always I've been fantasizing about having a conversation with you ever since I listened to your audio conversation that you recorded for your blog, Hidden Experience.
My podcast for I did that for 6 years. It's funny what happened is I loved it. I really got it was my therapy. That was my therapy. Those sessions, and when I started on the Owl Book stuff, like I just boom, it all ended. Mm. But man, that just shut down in 2014, and all my energy went into those books. So yeah, this feels good to be doing this again. It's funny. I still treat it as therapy in some way, you know? So I kind of went into this thinking like, oh, I'm done with my therapy and now I can just have a podcast, and I still recognize it's my therapy.
Yeah. Well, I think at least in this society we live in, therapy never ends, right?
We need it.
Yes. I don't think that psychiatrists will earn a lot of money if they say to the patients, okay, you're cured, you know, you don't have to come again. Go live your life.
I'm going to do the thing that I almost hate to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. How did you get interested in this subject?
It's a difficult question to answer. Truthfully, I was born in 1973, right? I take pride in the fact that I was born in a year that was so important in terms of encounters with humanoids and all of that. And I'm a child of the 80s. So I was born with watching Steven Spielberg's movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Cocoon. So I was, from the get-go, from as long as I can remember, I was interested in this thing. And maybe this interest even began before I was born. But what I mean by that is that some of my older relatives, some of my uncles and great-uncles, when they died and they bequeathed some of their books to me, I found a bunch of books delving into topics such as ancient astronaut theory, the Great Pyramid, that sort of stuff. So what I mean by this is, I think I recognize some kind of like that I belong to a lineage of people who were fascinated by very peculiar topics.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was a child of the 70s, and we had, you know, the first generation of movies or TV shows, I guess. I keep on going back to In Search Of. There's a television show with
right.
Leonard Nimoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And with me was Unsolved Mysteries, right?
Essentially the same type of show. Exactly. Yeah. Except one had Robert Stack and one had Leonard Nimoy.
Also, I have to mention that growing up in Mexico, I also used to watch the TV shows that were produced by this little-known guy by the name of Jaime Maussan.
I've met him. I've met him very briefly.
Yeah, well, Back in those days, he used to be a young producer for the Mexican version of 60 Minutes, right? So he was kind of like an investigative reporter. He used to cover all sorts of topics, especially something about the environment, things like that. And then one day he decided to do a segment on Edward Billy Meyer, the famous Swiss contactee. So imagine, you know, a kid who is, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, seeing those videos of Billy Meyer, his Pleiadian ships, his photos of these gleaming metal chrome polished saucers on a backdrop of a very bucolic European landscape. I don't know, there's something about that juxtaposition that was very evocative, very powerful to me. I was hooked, you know. So another of the reasons why I was very interested from the get-go in the UFO subject. And then when I grew up back in my high school days, there was an event here in Mexico in the year of 1991 when there was this total solar eclipse happening, and Mexico was in the path of the totality, right? And some people claim to have seen this object right in the moment of the sun's occultation. And that, to me, that's also very influential. That was, according to some, the beginning of a very active UFO wave that happened in the late or mid-1990s. And Jaime Maussan, like I said, was the go-to guy. You know, he used to be invited to all these late-night host TV shows, and he will present these to our, you know, nowadays we'll probably be non-too impressed with those videos of, you know, lights in the sky, whatever. But to me, that was it wasn't like my bread and butter. It was the thing that I always needed to try to get a hold on. And yeah, for some reason I decided to stick with it, you know, even though I eventually went to college and then got a job and all that, but the subject never left me.
Yeah, that's interesting. The eclipse, I mean, that's such a perfect kind of, I mean, almost like a science fiction-y script, you know, to have the eclipse be that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
The eclipse from, I think, 3 summers ago now, I think it would have been 2017, the one through North America. I'm living in New York State right now, but I used to live in Idaho. And the path of the eclipse, NASA had this website, and the track of the full eclipse, they had the line on this map. Mm-hmm. You could zoom in on it, and you could get the little line like 1 pixel thick, and you could just zoom in on the center of the line, and it passed right through my old cabin where I used to live. And that, where it passes through the line of longitude, is 111.111. So where the eclipse passes through my cabin is 111.111. Actually, by the time you get to that many digits on a line of longitude, you're dealing with a very short distance on the Earth itself, and it was technically in my driveway, but that did actually go right through my house.
Could that be, you mentioned the driveway, could that be the position of where you remember to have seen that big spherical light?
Oh, the orange flash?
Yeah, no. No, that, I'm thinking of that other memory of you peeking out through your window and seeing these beings.
Oh, that was actually Maine. That was Maine.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So yeah, so that was another house, but it also was a driveway. Yeah, so driveway. That was technically near the driveway.
Okay.
Right next to the driveway where that would have been. Yeah, driveways. Yeah, I did a blog post ages ago on driveways, and there was started to get a bunch of owl pictures from driveways, people sending me owls in their driveway. So, and it linked to a whole bunch of other stuff. But that was sort of my headspace at the time, just kind of trying to shamelessly connect all these puzzle pieces. It was kind of a mania on my part for years, that blog, you know, trying to obsessively make sense of this. And that is actually takes us to this, the question I wanted to ask is, you know, why is the subject of UFOs so obsessive?
It's a good question. Some years ago, a common friend of ours, Greg Bishop, interviewed this guy by the name of Bruce Duensing. Now, he wasn't a big name or in the UFO world. You know, he wasn't a researcher or anything. He was just a person like you and I. You know, someone who had been pondering on these topics for a very, very long time, and had reached his own conclusions. And at one point of that podcast, Greg asked him, you know, the hypothetical question, you know, if you were had the chance to sit in front of an alien being and ask it just one question, what would it be? And I still remember Bruce's response, because he said, if I were to ask an alien being just one question, it would be, what am I? And that to me is an interesting response, because I guess it kind of like makes me think that perhaps the obsession we have with the UFO topic is because we as a human species, the thing that we don't lack is like the other, in order to make sense of ourselves. What I mean by that is, like, we imagine you as an individual living all alone. You will be totally at a loss, because I feel human beings need other people in order to kind of like bounce back and to try to get a sense of who you are. Not because you need people to tell you who you are, but you need a reference point. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, you will see yourself in a reflection, and then you see other people and say, okay, so I know that I'm tall because I see other people that are shorter than me. I know that maybe I'm a bit of heavy set because I see people that are leaner than me, things like that. So maybe the reason why we are so obsessed with the idea of UFOs, non-human entities that may or may not be visiting our world, is because we are desperate to have that point of reference in order to understand who we, the human, as human beings, what we really are.
You know, when I would talk about UFOs to people, you know, there's this kind of, I want to be careful. I want to say a gauge. I don't want to say it's a judgment thing, but any thoughtful person, and I've said this many times and written it too, but any thoughtful two people who begin a conversation on UFOs, if they're really pondering the questions, it won't take but 5 minutes before they get to, what does it all mean? Why am I here? What's the meaning of life? You know, who is God? You know, these kind of questions are interwoven into this mystery. Mm-hmm. And that's what concerns me. I think a lot of, and I want to be, I don't want to, again, I just want to, don't want to be too judgmental, but I think that there's an aspect of the nuts and bolts research, I'll say MUFON, right? The MUFON establishment, that doesn't end up at that question. You know, they're wrestling with other things, which are important, and it's probably worthwhile to, you know, document that stuff. But to me, I'm trying to wrestle with those bigger, deeper questions.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that UFOs should be anyone's gateway drug, if you want to use that analogy. It will be something that will open your mind to the bigger mysteries, and that will have to lead you, like you said, from asking yourself about life in other planets, and then thanks to ufology, you will probably learn a lot about history, about astronomy, maybe about physics, chemistry, and mythology. And then I think if you follow this path correctly, because to me it's almost like a spiritual path. You know, it's a path that leads to a betterment of yourself, both you know, intellectually, you know, mentally, maybe, you know, even spiritually. If you go through this path, you start to find things that don't really add up to this notion that we are being just visited by little scientists who come in structured metal craft to our planet to conduct experiments or to do whatever. You read the works of people like Terence McKenna, you read the works of John Keel, you read the works of maybe people outside the United States, Salvador Freixedo in Spain, JJ Benitez also in Spain, and you realize, wait a minute, you know, there is more here. And then you read the works of Jacques Vallée, who tells you, well, you know, there's also a psychic component that we need to factor in. And the nuts and bolts people are like, no, we need to get rid of that garbage, because we need to make a case, you know, we need to present this case before this imaginary judge that is going to gauge our evidence. So we cannot abide to putting all this psychic nonsense or all these ideas or maybe, heavens forbid, to admit that there's also other mysteries that cross-pollinate with UFOs, like, for example, cryptozoology, you know, Stan Gordon saying that people who have seen UFOs, they also encounter Bigfoot-like creatures.
Yes.
And that's like, no!
I know a few people who have. That's remarkable, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm interested in... I'm more interested now in where these fields tend to, like, intersect than the center of the fields themselves. You know what I mean? Like, I prefer the outliers. I feel... it's in the outliers when we can probably start to see, if not the answers to these mysteries, but maybe to ask ourselves better questions about it.
Precisely, precisely. Hey, we are going to need to take our very first break. Mm-hmm. For free listeners, you will be hearing a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff. Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like, and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as a Kindle, as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on Audible.com.
We are back on The Unseen with my friend Red Pill Junkie, and we are talking about the outlying stuff that has to do with UFOs. And for me, that is where my heart is. I mean, so what you said just before the break is what I feel. I'll tell one little funny story here. I was at a UFO conference. This is going back probably 7 years ago or so now. And it was at the UFO conference that's held annually in Arizona, in down near Phoenix, the IUFOC. And this was the final dinner, the final event. And I had a suit on, which I very rarely wear. And James Fox was there. And then also Lee Spiegel is there. We were kind of mingling, and I walked up to him, and I asked Lee Spiegel, I said, hey, you know, I've been following your work on the Huffington Post, and I notice you don't really cover the subject of abductions at all. And he very plainly said, yes, yeah, that's done on purpose. We just want to be taken seriously. And I kind of was, oh, I just, my heart sank. And Lee Spiegel is a great guy, so I'm not, I understand what he meant, but at the same time, it was a drag. And and then I went up to James Fox and I said, hey, you're working on this new documentary. I understand you're working on this new documentary. And how's that going? He's like, oh, it's going great. I think it's going to be this really great thing. And it's like, hey, are you going to cover abductions in this new documentary? He goes, no, we want to be taken seriously. And so this happened. These two conversations happened like, you know, within 5 minutes of each other. And I remember I gave him this look like, was just like, oh, God. And he knew it. We exchanged business cards and did the kind of thing you do at a formal event like that. To James Fox's credit, and he called me up a couple days later, back when I was home in Idaho, and he asked me, he said, "Hey, you know, listen, I recognize that, you know, that was an emotional subject for you, and I apologize." So we had a long, wonderful conversation, and so he takes it very seriously, and it meant a lot to me that he called me back just to kind of quiz. What he wanted to ask more than anything is if I knew what would be a very reputable, someone who would have good camera presence to talk about their experiences. And I gave him a few names, and I think he actually, this is going back a few years, but I think he did actually cover Travis in that documentary. I can't remember exactly when that was. But that mentality of I want to be taken seriously. I mean, everyone's got their crazy line, right? Where there's like a line in the sand and something on the other side of that line is like, well, I'm not going there. Everyone's got that.
Sure.
I think if you don't step over that line, at least search around on the other side, you're doing yourself and the subject a disservice.
Yeah, let's put the example of people like artists like David Bowie. It's not like artists like David Bowie change themselves in order to fit in and be accepted by the culture. They stay exactly who they are, who they were. And what happened is that the culture eventually changed and started to reach where they had been all along. You know, the same thing with, I don't know, advocates of the LGBT culture. A friend of mine is a friend of Dan Savage, who used to have a column in some newspaper, you know, back in the 80s, back when, you know, being in the closet for the gay community was still a huge deal. And those people, what they did was forced the culture to like reach out to where they were, not the other way around. And maybe that is the problem with people in the UFO community who take that attitude of, oh, well, we need to change and we need to polish our act so that we can be taken seriously by the powers that be, or by the academy, or by, you know, this hierarchy in which we want to be accepted. And what I say is that, no, sorry, but F that, you know.
Yeah.
We are outsiders. We have a role to play as the outsiders of culture, that we are in this vantage position in which we can see the problems that are in the culture that people who are too deeply involved with it are probably blinded or are myopic to those problems. And we have this opportunity to raise those problems. And if we're lucky, the culture might pay attention to us at the right moment, and then the culture change, and then what was in the outlier becomes the mainstream, and then somebody from the outside needs to come in and try to shake things up one more time. Otherwise, things become stagnant. So I think that's the problem with the ufology. Ufology wants to take seriously. It's like almost like in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Roy Neary, who is in that conference with the Air Force, and he wants so desperately to be taken seriously. And then there's that old guy who says, I saw Bigfoot in 1957. You can see the poor man saying, oh, God.
And then the fact that, you know, that's part of the whole thing, too, which is like the, I mean, I have to guess that the scriptwriters had no idea that Bigfoot is somehow interwoven with the UFO mystery. Maybe they did. I don't know. But you know, seeing that movie now, what is it, nearly 40 years later, you know, that line to me is like, well, yeah, Bigfoot. Bigfoot is interwoven into the UFO lore.
Mm-hmm.
The need to be, and I like to be taken seriously, but at the same time, like, I can't water down my story to please someone else.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that's sort of a flaw in my makeup, I guess. You know, that just because it's funny because I've had like, you know, like the job interview where someone will call me from a radio station and they'll say like, so we want to talk to you about, what's your subject? What do you talk about? And I'm like, I could give some examples of the network. I won't say anything, but you know, like, oh, it's UFOs and owls. And then I got like 20 seconds to make my pitch, you know, and you can just hear them on the other end of the phone, like, oh, click, you lose, you know. It's tough. It's tough.
Here's the thing. I mean, I feel that when people do that, when people say, okay, we need to make our case, and so we need to strip down these things that may seem too wacko or to see, doesn't seem to make any sense, you risk leaving out the most important part of the mystery. And this is something that I wanted to try to touch upon when I wrote the foreword for your book. It was the commemoration of your 10th year anniversary of your blog, Hidden Experience, when I mentioned the story of Johannes Kepler, who was like the first true astronomer, you know, before, you know, when astrology became a quote-unquote true science. And he was trying to come up with this concept of the paths of the planets revolving the sun, right? So he had this really interesting idea that came to him in this moment of inspiration, that the planets were moving according to the shapes of what is called the Platonic solids, you know, the cube, the tetrahedron, the icosahedron, the dodecahedron, all those things. So he thought that he had found evidence of these cosmic geometries, God, in the way that the planets were moving in the trajectory around the sun. And he was trying to make that case using observational data. But the problem is that at the end of the day, one tiny problem had with his master theory, and that was the trajectory of the planet Mars. Mars was the one that in the sky has the most eccentric trajectory. And there was this guy, Tycho Brahe, who told him, you need to pay attention to Mars, otherwise you're not going to solve this. And to Kepler's credit, he did that, and he was forced to throw out his grand perfect geometry theory that he had first envisioned, but he did come with the actual trajectories of the planets that revolve around the sun on an elliptical orbit, right? Mm-hmm. And with that, he laid the foundations for what then Newton used in order to come up with the laws of gravity and all that. So that is the value of paying attention to the things that mess around with your tiny little perfect model of the universe. That to me is the UFO phenomenon. You have this really nice house of cards, perfect in any way, that you feel that explains things as they should be. And here comes the UFO phenomenon that just, ping, it, you know, just rattles a bit of one of the cards and everything falls down.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I think, what happens with any UFO witness. Right. So they have to wrestle with, you know, I guess things are a little different in the last 3 years or so now since the New York Times put that article out. But our consensus culture says there's no such thing as UFOs, except when you see one, then you have to you're no longer standing on bedrock. You're standing on sand.
Yeah.
And you have to rebuild that bedrock somehow. And it's not bedrock. It's something completely different. You know, it might be some balancing act you're doing at this point. But I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like what happens. Everybody goes through that, right? At one point in their lives, during adolescence, when you're trying to figure out who you are, and you have the bedrock, the foundation you're talking, the one that was laid down by your parents about, you know, the rules or your this moral, maybe religious values that you were taught in. And then in order to actually become a true person, you have to discard all that and you have to start from scratch, which is one of the reasons why that is a particular traumatic period for most humans in our society.
Teenage years, yeah.
Yeah, teenagers, right? It's called growing pains. It's the reason why it's called adolescence, because you are like in constant pain, you know, like trying to decide who you are. Now imagine going through that all over again when you're an adult.
I know about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost like Spock. Remember how male Vulcans go through the Ponfar, which is kind of like going through puberty, but when you're a grown-up.
Yeah, he takes over the Enterprise and hijacks it back to his home planet, yeah, to mate. Yeah, I love that episode.
Cool.
Hey, we are going to need to take our second and final break. For free listeners, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. Whitley Strieber said this about The Messengers.
It's a wonderful book because it's a book that advances us in consciousness. It advances us. It takes us from where we were before we started reading it to a new place in terms of understanding the close encounter experience. I can name just on the fingers of one hand the number of books that actually do that.
The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. Stories from The Messengers, Owls, UFOs, and a Deeper Reality. This is the second in the series, and it tells a series of 19 real-life stories, each with UFOs and owls. The third is Hidden Experience, a memoir of owls, synchronicity, and UFO contact. This is my own story, my emotional journey of coming to terms with very challenging memories and experiences. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
The key, the mystery, the wonder. Now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin, Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. we're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you. The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats.
We are back on The Unseen with my friend Red Pill Junkie, and we are talking about UFOs and the research and the problems that are inherent in this research. Hey, I'm going to read an excerpt. This was from the essay you wrote in Robbie's book, Robbie Graham's book, which is called UFOs, Reframing the Debate. It has a great cover, by the way, which you did as an art director. And I guess I should give you a little plug there. So yes, you and I are both art directors and illustrators, even though I haven't done much in the last few years. I've put all my energies into the writing part as opposed to the illustration part. But in Robbie's book, I'm going to read a little quote. You wrote, Arthur C. Clarke once wrote that any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. Perhaps he forgot to consider how any sufficiently advanced mentality would equally be indistinguishable from madness. What point were you trying to make there?
Well, I remember once imagining myself going back to the age of Leonardo da Vinci. You know, I guess because, like I said, I'm a child of the 80s, so I also was influenced by Carl Sagan's Cosmos. And there is this chapter in which he goes to the Italian Tuscany to retrace the steps of the young Albert Einstein. And also in that episode, he also talks about Leonardo da Vinci. And I thought how difficult it would be to try to explain to someone like Leonardo, who was probably one of the biggest intellect in the whole world back in his age, try to explain perhaps not our technology, but our habits and our intentions. Imagine trying to explain, okay, so yeah, humans in the world in 500 years from now will be able to connect to all people instantaneously, and children and teenagers will have all the knowledge of mankind at the palm of their hands, but that amazing technology will be mostly devoted to seeing cat videos. He probably come to the conclusion that humans in the future had gone insane. And, you know, maybe he's right from his point of view. So now imagine translating that to an intelligence that is probably thousands upon thousands of years more advanced than us and was not even evolved in our world. You know, if you want to go to the ETH Entertainment for a little bit, imagine trying to understand the rationale of a being that was evolved, in another with another biology system. There is a philosopher, I forget his name, I think he's a French one, who once said, if lions were able to speak English or our language, we still wouldn't be able to understand them, you know? And that's because what lions, they are mammals. They are very close to humans, biologically speaking. You know, probably just a few percentage of DNA of difference between a lion and a human being. And yet, the world of a lion is completely different than the world of a man. Why? Because the impulses are different, their habits are different, their drives and their needs are different. So that's what I mean, that maybe what we are seeing in the UFO phenomenon, the reason why the governments of the world have a lot of trouble acknowledging the existence of UFOs is because they really can't make sense of the UFO's behavior, because there is this absurdity that at the heart of it that is very problematic, especially, like I tried to make the case in that particular essay, problematically, especially for the institutions at the top of our society. Why? Because institutions, the way they gain and maintain power is by trying to have this structure of how things should behave, you know?
Yeah.
But UFOs don't behave by our rules. They don't even seem to behave by our logical rules. I mean, UFOs' behavior is totally irrational. Someone like Stephen Hawking used to make fun of UFOs because he couldn't understand why alien beings would rather contact farmers in Nebraska or single moms in Missouri or Buenos Aires than contact him, who is, you know, was one of the smartest men of our generation, you know? So therefore, UFOs are nonsense. Well, no, but just because UFOs don't make a sense to how you would like them to behave doesn't mean that UFOs don't exist.
That's the challenge. If you anthropomorphize them, if you want to turn the UFOs, the UFO occupants, into us somehow, that's perfect if it's a Star Trek episode, but it doesn't work if it's given the available evidence.
Exactly.
Yeah. How does shamanism fit into this overall quandary of the UFOs?
Well, we will first have to try to identify what we mean when we use the term shaman. Like shaman, we know that anthropologists apply them to other cultures outside of our Western civilization. It's actually a term that was derived from a Russian word, I guess.
Yes, shaman, I think, is the word. Yeah.
Exactly. But basically, it's like the elder man or like the medicine doctor in a tribe, and the guy who or woman, obviously, because it's not, obviously not gender related. In fact, a very interesting thing about shamans, we talked about David Bowie previously. Another a very interesting thing about shamans is that they are gender fluid. You know, like a male shaman will deliberately dressed in female clothes, and perhaps maybe vice versa, and that's very interesting. So there is this transgression, right? There's like this role of the shaman to go against the rules of the tribe, to try to knock them down, just to keep the society dynamic and prevent them to going from stagnation. And someone like Terence McKenna will go to UFO conference and annoy the crap out of ufologists by saying, well, all this talk about communication with alien beings is no biggie in other cultures. You know, you go to an Amazonian shaman and he will say, of course, I can talk to alien beings. I only need to drink this very nasty beverage called ayahuasca, and I can talk to beings from all sorts of realms. But obviously that's not what ufologists want to hear, right? And the thing is that in those cultures, that there seems to be a better integration of accepting these different realms of existence and having a better, I don't know, rapport, like a better communication, a better communion, if we want to use that term, which I think actually is a great term, a better communion with those realms, in contrast with our own culture, which is still refusing to admit not only the existence of UFOs, but even the possibility that consciousness is able to survive physical death, right? We're so enamored with our materialism because, oh, well, materialism gave us our iPhones and or gave us the internet and gave us, I don't know, Bob's Burgers or whatever, and thinks, oh, materialism is the end-all be-all of everything. But materialism doesn't seem to be able to explain UFOs, not entirely, as we have been saying here in this conversation, not if we actually observe the UFO mystery in its totality, if we're just not focused on the alloys or the propulsion systems, on this or that, if we don't just nitpick and go and try to understand the mystery in full, then materialism seems to fall terribly short. But with shamanism, it seems that these cultures have been able to adequate they've been able to interact with these levels of existence in a more productive way, in probably more healthy too, because I'm very worried in how people who claim the contact experience in our culture, the way they are treated, you know, they're treated as if they are or liars or delusional, insane, and the way that our society treats them is very poor, very, very unfair. Maybe if they went to speak to a shaman in the Amazons or in the deserts of Africa, they would be able to get better treatment and better support than if they went to a psychiatrist in Johns Hopkins Hospital or something.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, that John Mack, his final book, Passport to the Cosmos, had a huge influence on me, where he compared and contrasted the shamanic initiation, you know, the what we would call the primitive cultures that have a shamanic initiation process. He compared and contrasted that to the UFO contact experience. It's, you know, it's when I ran my other podcast, we talked about this a little bit earlier, there was a couple questions, not everyone, but I asked nearly everyone two questions. One was about the owls, you know, what's up with the owls? And the other question was, how would you define a shaman? And it's very strange because I didn't really tie those two together. I tie them together now, but at the time I did not tie them together at all. And now I see these as absolutely linked, where the owl would be the totem animal of the shaman. Mm-hmm. And that's understood in a great many cultures. I'm not stepping out on a limb to say that.
Yeah.
And then, I guess the role the shaman plays in society. I think we are bereft. We have a void in our society. We do not have a shaman in our society. We have people doing shaman-like things, a little half step back where people are doing, and there's obviously real shamans around, but not to the meaningful extent that like every village would have had, you know, a teepee at the edge of the village where you could have talked with a shaman. We don't quite have that now. You know, we have people doing Reiki, which I consider a shaman-like, you know, ritual or skill, let's say. And so I think we are adrift in some ways without our shamans. I postulated in my second book that perhaps the UFO occupants are seeding the planet with shamans. You know, they're trying to create shamans. And the shamanic initiation is brutal. You know, people are taken to the edge of death.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I mean, to me, I will still leave the question open of which came first, the chicken or the egg. Is it that the phenomenon is the one responsible for seeding the shamans, or is it that the shamans are produced naturally by some little understood law of the universe, and the UFOs are naturally attracted to those shamans, the same way that, a moth is naturally attracted to a light bulb. I'll go to see that guy because he's the one who is shining the brightest.
Yeah, I follow that logic. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, you have read a lot of Castaneda.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that helped you with your UFO studies?
It's a good question. I read Castaneda when I was in my final years of college. And I found interesting parallels between the narrative, the stories that Castaneda was writing about. And let's not go into the details of whether he was telling the truth or not. This is not really the time for it. But there was some correlations between that and what I perceived in the UFO phenomenon. One interesting thing about it is that Castaneda, he talks about these main core of experiences, right? When he was under Don Juan's apprenticeship. Don Juan was this Yaqui brujo that he became like his Carlos tutor, and Carlos became like this sorceress apprentice of sorts. And then there's all the other characters that appear in Carlos's life. And then there is this like secret life that Carlos starts to gradually remember of things that were happening when he went down to Mexico to visit Don Juan. But there was these like teachings that were happening in a different state of consciousness, what he called the consciousness of the Nahual, and in his philosophy, our everyday consciousness is tonal, and when there's in this heightened state of consciousness, is called the Nahual state. So that to me seems to have a lot of resonance with people in the UFO world, the ones who claim to have had the contact experience, and they feel they have this secret life that is totally unknown even to them. And sometimes they try to get a hold of them through the use of hypnosis or other techniques, and sometimes it naturally is reintegrated into their normal consciousness. I feel that parallel was very interesting, and yeah, you know, maybe there's a lot of us who have this secret life that we really don't have a lot of clue of. I mean, it's almost like trying to remember your dream after you wake up, right?
Absolutely, yeah. The dream realm, that's the, I equate the dream realm so strongly with the contact experience.
Yeah.
Where I see, like, to untangle these strange stories, you don't need the skills of a UFO investigator. You would need the skills of a dream interpreter,
mm-hmm.
right? So people say, like, oh my God, I had this UFO contact experience and all this strange stuff went on, and then to navigate those waters, I say, like, just treat reality, even if it's just seeing a flying saucer, you know, in the sky at night, you know, no contact in the sort of abduction way that we sometimes frame it. But I would say that even in the simplest UFO sightings, there's often a symbolic element,
yes,
or a dreamlike element that shows up within there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some seed that is implanted and that is probably going to, not in all of people, but in some people it will manifest probably in their subconscious. And if they're lucky, you know, maybe that subconscious part gets to talk to the conscious part at one point.
I have a very close friend, and she had a powerful UFO sighting. She was driving down a road at night, and there was kind of a rural road, but there were some houses around. And she turns this corner, and there's this huge hovering UFO just at treetop levels, giant triangle craft. And her little son was in the back seat, and she hops out of the car and she runs to the nearest house and he pounds on the door. She's like, get out here. You got to see this. Basically, she didn't believe it. She wanted someone else to see it too. Get out here. You got to see this. And just as the people come out, it slowly eases off over the trees and is gone. The people claim to have seen a little glow. They said they could certainly see a glow. They couldn't make out what it was at that point. It was beyond the trees. So she gets back in her car and she drives. And the next turn was a T-intersection, right? So you get to a stop sign. There's a T-intersection, so you have to either go right or left. So she gets to this intersection, and there's a fox at the stop sign. Now, to me, like, the most interesting part of the story is the fox.
Right.
Like, that's dream logic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, that's open to interpretation, what that might mean. But so is any dream.
Yeah. And with Castañeda, there weren't any foxes, but there were coyotes, you know. And under the influence of Mezcalito, you know, peyote, he used to talk to coyotes and to receive knowledge from them.
So you are a child of the 80s. I'm a child of the 70s. And let me tell you, those books, those Castaneda's books, The Teachings of Don Juan, were everywhere when I was growing up. Like, everyone had them in their house. And you didn't need to buy them. You could get those. You could get all of them at any point, any time, at any garage sale. Those books had such a strong presence. And it's faded now. I mean, they're still in publication, and there's some wonderful audio readings, audio books of them. But and I have only read the very first one, The Teachings of Don Juan, and I loved it. I found it surprisingly dense. I didn't expect it to be so dense. I remember in high school, we would just read the drug parts and I'll laugh at him, but you know, it was so funny the way he wrote. But even now, it's still pretty funny, but there's a lot more to it than just the, you know, the psychedelic trip.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, you know. I mean, and even if you dismiss his claims of, visiting this brujo, receiving this knowledge and being able to create these amazing feats of consciousness, like seeing the universe as it really is, like lines of energy converging in beings in the world in the form of glowing eggs, just like similar to, you know, what happens by the end of the first Matrix movie, right? Which is the reason why I actually chose the moniker Red Pill Junkie, because I saw these very important correlation between the teachings of Castañeda and this science fiction story told by the Wachowski siblings. But even if you dismiss all of that, there's still really interesting philosophical ideas that have a lot of merit. Like, for example, the idea of taking responsibility for your actions, living your life as a warrior, for example, that still, I feel, applies. The idea that you, as a human being, have to be conscious every moment of your life to the fact that you are going to die. And the moment that you accept that, you integrate that fully, then every act of your life will be calculated the same way that a warrior calculates their moves before they go to battle, because it is literally something of a matter of life and death. When you realize, when you stop acting as an immortal being, like saying, I have time to do that later. When you say, no, actually you won't. You have these X amount of minutes or X amount of heartbeats that are allotted to your life. So what are you going to do with them? What are you going to do with them? If you actually pay attention to that, then everything becomes clearer to you. And mind you, I'm not saying that I've been able to master this. You know, I'm still just a fool like most of us, you know, living life moment to moment, wasting too many precious moments, checking on my Twitter feed and all of that. But still, from time to time, I try to remember those teachings and try to keep them at least in the back of my mind to remember, I am going to die. And it's going to be sooner rather than later.
It's a one-way road. Yeah. Well, you know what? And so this is, I'm going to, Leo Sprinkle, he must be 90. He must be in his early 90s now. Mm-hmm. I should reach out and talk to him. He's been an incredible, kind mentor to me. I haven't talked to him in a few years. Mm-hmm. He has been doing UFO research since the early 60s. So he's got nearly 60 years, over 50 years, where he has essentially been using the same questionnaire. So his data pool is remarkable. And one of the things that I said, you know, what came out of that data pool? I said, you know what's interesting is, so you ask the cross-section of the population, do you believe in reincarnation? And it fluctuates depending on where you are and who you ask and stuff like that. But it's, you know, there's this, a certain percentage say yes. People who have had UFO contact. And I think I'm doing this right. I think he even if people have simply seen a UFO, it's so close to 100% that he basically rounds it off to 100%. He says 100% of the people who have had UFO contact believe in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we have death at the end, and then, you know, it's a cycle. So whether we come back in the ways that, you know, might be in a, you know, corny Hollywood movie, or if it's something more nuanced and more subtle, I can only imagine, I can only guess, but I certainly believe in reincarnation. And I thought that was a remarkable finding that I've never really heard anyone else talk about. And we're back to that, you know, what does it all mean? You know, why are we here?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And aside from The Matrix, the Wachowski siblings made a movie that I really like, Cloud Atlas, which also deals with the idea of reincarnation. And in the case of that movie, he's trying to, like, learn compassion and try to learn to be selfless and to live in the service of others instead of just living to satisfy your own selfish needs. And yeah, you know, maybe that is one of the things that we are here, you know, the same way that when Wheatley was kind of like channeling like the visitors at one point, and his late wife Anne was asking this question of like, what is the earth? And he received the answer, the earth is a school. You know, I think that Leo Sprinkle has also talked about in that sense. Well, yeah, maybe it's a school, or maybe it's a reformatory, you know. Maybe it's a school for all the kids who were kicked out of the nice schools, you know, were sent out, and we're just trying to, you know, survive, preventing the bullies to punch us and steal our lunch money.
Yeah, but it takes us back to those deeper questions. And so that's, I think it was Ray Palmer, who originally was the publisher of Fate magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna do this quote poorly, but he said, UFOs are here to make us think.
Mm-hmm.
And I would amend that to say, UFOs are here to make us think deeply.
Exactly.
And it's tough. It's tough. I mean, so this is the problem is, you know, a lot of people are having terrible, traumatic, brutal, frightening, hellish experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrestle with that. You know, there's a strong pull in some segments of the community to paint it all, you know, as unicorns and rainbows and sparkles and
right.
You can do that. You can cherry pick the data, and you can find that evidence out there. That evidence is out there, but you have to willfully ignore other evidence to focus on that.
And to that, I will respond. A friend of mine interviewed this very important pioneer of the psychedelic revolution, Gene Fadiman, who's still around. He's still working as a psychedelic guide. He's actually the guy who started the microdosing movement that's got on a hold of a lot of people in Silicon Valley and the like. So he says that there's been studies conducted of people who are asked, you know, what is your most profound psychedelic experience? And a lot of people even choose negative experience as their most profound one, because not because they enjoyed it, but because the amount of things they got to learn from them. To the point that people like Gene Fadiman says there are no quote-unquote bad trips. They are just challenging trips. So I feel in that regard, the UFO experience and the psychedelic experience are very in common. You know, with the psychedelics, they talk about set and setting. They never talk about set and setting when it comes to UFO experiences. But maybe what happens with negative UFO experiences is the same thing that happens with bad trips, that people haven't had the chance or the proper circumstances to properly integrate them into their psyche and to see what they can learn from them. And like I said, obviously it's not like, hey, yeah, I want to have a bad UFO experience. Nobody says that. Nobody goes and takes a tab of LSD saying, yeah, let's go for a bad trip. Nobody wants that. Nevertheless, that's what you get, and sometimes those can be incredibly important in your life, nevertheless.
Yes. Here, let me just frame my thought. Okay, let me just think this through for a second. Hey, this is Mike. I am chiming in during the editing. I recorded this last night, and I got kind of frustrated, because while RPJ was talking, I knew what I wanted to say, and then I got kind of lost in what he was saying, which was really interesting. And now, during the editing, listening to it again, the exact same thing came up, the thing that I could not remember. And so I'll share it now. And I actually just tried to look for the quote, and I heard it during an audio interview, and I cannot find it. But I think I can paraphrase it pretty well. So I remember a quote from Joseph Campbell, and this was in the context of someone really following their own path, and to go within, to have an inward journey as well as striking out on their own. And Joseph Campbell said something to the effect of, this is a terribly dangerous path, a path where many have failed. You are walking on the edge of a razor, and the danger is you could fall into yourself. But it is in this danger of going it alone and following some deeper drive that this is where you will find the real rewards. Now, I probably got that a little wrong, but I feel like that's pretty close. Okay, back to the interview. Okay, so you didn't realize this, but I had written one of the questions. Here was UFOs as a psychedelic experience, and I had it on my computer, and I had it underlined, and that's what I do when I'm getting ready to ask the next question. I didn't need to ask it. You just jumped right in there and asked. You just answered the question before I asked it. So, yes, this is a psychedelic experience. It is a, I would argue that this is, yes, it's here to make us think. It's here to transform us. I am arguing that because it fits tidy, right? So I may be wrong, but that's the best thing I'm holding on to right now as far as a way to, the big why of this mystery.
And remember the root of the word psychedelic, Mike, comes from the Greek, and it literally means soul manifesting.
Yes.
So I think there are many ways in which the soul can be manifested. And I honestly believe that in some cases, UFOs can be such a way.
Yes. And that I would think of Alan Stiefelman's film, Witness of Another World, is a mm-hmm. beautiful example.
Yes.
Of almost everything we've talked about here. Have you seen his movie, Humano?
I haven't yet.
You should.
I will promise as soon as we finish this, I'm going to.
I'm not putting pressure on you, but I did an interview with him on that movie. I don't think he's been interviewed on that movie, and he was really happy to talk about it. It is such a subtle movie. He went to work with a shaman. He was basically depressed. I mean, that was as simple as way as everything. And he begins the movie by showing pictures of himself. And he's a little kid, and then as he gets to the age he's at, he's smiling less and less and less. And he just shows it in these pictures, a very subtle way to get his point across. And then he just carries a video camera around with him and videotapes a bunch of stuff when he's working with a shaman. And he had no intention of making a movie into it. And the movie is just this footage that he just kind of was keeping a video diary. And it turned into this remarkably moving video. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a video. It was a film in its totality. It was a powerful, beautiful film. And you can see the stepping stone that film was to what would be his much more popular film, Witness of Another World.
And in the case of Alan, it seems as if grabbing that camera and beginning that journey is the way in which he managed to find his path with heart, to use that beautiful metaphor from Carlos Castaneda's book. And yeah, I know of that kind of depression. I feel that depression comes when you are not following the path with heart that is the one you are supposed to follow. I feel, I hope that now that, that I'm doing my things that are involved in some way or another with the UFO phenomenon, that I am following my path with heart. And I actually feel that is one of the reasons why I probably haven't jumped off of a building or whatever. And I'm sure with your case is the same. When the moment that you started your blog, Hidden Experience, the moment that you started with those interviews, that's when you, Mike, found your path with heart. And that path of obviously is now evolved into this podcast of yours, The Unseen.
Thank you for saying that. But yes, and I recognize a couple things happened when I started doing the blog. I started getting people contacting me and thanking me for giving them a voice for things that they were struggling with. And I learned very early on that I had a responsibility to speak my truth as clearly as I could, and to understand that there were people out there finding solace with my struggles. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've made tremendous advancements from where I was when I was working on initially starting the blog. I mean, I've flip-flopped. I've had the death and rebirth experience multiple times in this lifetime, but that was a huge one, you know, struggling with these bigger questions in the framework of UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here in our civilization, Mike, especially in recent years, there's this obsession with achieving happiness, right? Like, oh, you know, everybody needs to be happy all the time. You know, why aren't you happy? You know, why aren't you consciously striving to be happy? And I feel that, for at least in my life, it's more important to find meaning than to find happiness. You know what I mean? Then meaning is more important than to try to be happy, because nobody's happy all the time. You know, it's even become a reason to be stressed out. You say, oh my God, I'm not as happy as that girl who is posting in Instagram that I follow. she looks so happy. It's a form of
torturing ourselves with all this immediate, you know. I understand I put a picture every once in a while up on Facebook and such, but yeah, I recognize that it creates this schizophrenia in our society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think that finding a path, finding something meaningful, not only to you, but also to others. And yeah, I'm also being grateful enough that people read what I have to say in the Daily Grail or Mysterious Universe or people listen to me when I'm invited to podcast interviews like this one. And people, sometimes they write to me and they thank me because they find what I have to say important to them. And I feel that is what is giving meaning to my life. And I feel, okay, I may not find like the answers to the universe or the answers to the UFO phenomenon. I'm very okay to the fact that I will go to my grave without ever finding out the truth about UFOs. Just that, to me, that's not important. And as cliche as it sounds, the journey has been far more rewarding, you know, than the destination.
I agree. And it's a tough journey. It's not an easy journey.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's tough. And here, let me just, I'll close this out in a moment here. And I'm going to read a quote from Castaneda. And this is a quote that I read many, many times when I did my outdoor work. Oh, here's what I was going to say at one point. We were talking about time and how it feels like time is fleeting. Now, I worked in the mountains and I took people out into the mountains. And we were down in the beautiful desert southwest of Utah, just the spectacular canyon country there, near what's called the Escalante region. And there was it wasn't a crew of adults, so everyone in the crew was an adult. And we had this incredible vista, and the sun was setting. It was getting dark. And all of a sudden, right on the horizon, this is the horizon line, was just the trippy, undulating, orange-red rock that they have down there. All of a sudden, there was this hot orange glow right on the horizon, this dot. And we all looked at it. It's like, what is that? And slowly, 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 the moon rose. And the moon, this full moon, rose up. It's about a 5-minute process for the moon to, from that seeing that first little dot as it peaks over the horizon until the moon is fully up. And it was the most riveting experience to be in a group like that. So I've spent a lot of time outdoors, so I've seen a lot of moonrises. There was a few people who had never seen a moonrise. It was such a powerful spiritual experience. So, hey, you know what? So first, I'm going to thank you right now, and then I'm going to read this quote. But thank you so much. This has been great. I have taken a sort of hiatus for about 3 weeks. I just didn't have the energy. I just, everything, just the virus and just being stuck and just all the, I just had a project I was in the middle of, and I just didn't have the energy to do the podcast for the last 3 weeks. And this feels so good to be doing it again. So I have to thank you for saying yes. I needed this. This is exactly the podcast I needed, exactly the talk I needed to have.
No, thank you, Mike. I mean, I have to say that I need these two in my life, you know, this kind of conversations in which I get to express this side of myself.
Yeah. Yeah, publicly too, and to say it out loud to the world. I mean, it's, yeah, you have to choose your words carefully. You have to, if you're going to say this to the world, you have to be cautious in how you present yourself, and so it comes out meaningful. Not that I'm trying to sugarcoat anything or hide anything, but that it, so it comes out meaningful. You know what I'm going to do? And I thought about this during your talk. I'm going to plug the introduction that you read at the end of this interview. I'll just tack it on at the very end. It's about 13 minutes long, as I recall. So back to this outdoor work that I did. I read this on every outdoor trip I have ever done. Any path is only a path, and there is no affront to oneself or to others in dropping it if that is what your heart tells you to do. Look at every path closely and deliberately. Then ask yourself, and yourself alone, one question. Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it does not, it is of no use. And that's from Carlos Castaneda, from the first book, the first Don Juan book, The Teachings of Don Juan.
Yeah.
Again, just thank you. This has been great.
Thank you, Mike. Muchas gracias.
You're very welcome. This is Mike, and I am chiming in at the end of the editing. I need to say how much I needed to do this exact interview on this exact day. It felt great. And just a few minutes ago, you heard me say that I would plug in the audio forward that was created for the audiobook of my most recent book, Hidden Experience. I asked RPJ to do the forward because he had been a longtime reader of the blog, and he showed up right at the beginning, and that was way back in 2009. Now, Red Pill Junkie, perhaps more than anyone else, knew the ins and outs of my online presence in a way that it was an obvious choice for him to write the foreword to that book. Now, I said it earlier, but this interview went a little bit long, so I won't say too much more. And now, again, the delightful voice of Red Pill Junkie.
Foreword by Red Pill Junkie. It's a question you occasionally stumble upon when you read an article about UFOs, published by some mainstream media outlet. Oh, where have all the alien abductees gone? You know, the same news sites that also love to comment from time to time on the steady decline of UFO sightings. Only with the phenomenon currently known as alien abduction, the cynicism is even more blatant, because at best, popular culture regards it as a 90s fad, promoted by the X-Files, which the public eventually grew tired of. The same way rollerblades and Tamagotchi pets became passé. And at worst, it's still associated with crass proctological jokes, thanks to the irreverent humor of Matt Stone and Trey Parker. But truth be told, answering that question is rather easy. The abductees didn't go anywhere. They simply discovered the power of the internet and started blogging. A path that hid them from the judgmental eyes of a public who never really made an effort to make sense of their claims or empathize with their anguish. From skeptics who accused them of lying and being nothing but attention seekers. And from psychiatrists who sought only to interpret their claims merely from a pathological perspective. In an age that has witnessed significant advancements in accepting the rights of the LGBT community, the people who claim to have had close encounters of the fourth kind seem to be locked inside the ultimate cultural closet. As an aside, it's also interesting to notice certain parallels in the search for identity of both groups, like the infighting concerning the correct use of terms and pronouns, like, for example, experiencer versus abductee versus contactee. Blogging also freed abductees, or experiencers, whatever floats your saucer, from the need of sharing their stories with some intermediary in order to reach a larger audience. I am of the opinion that these biased middlemen, be that a UFO investigator or a TV producer, are often more interested in trying to pigeonhole witnesses' brushes with the other in a way that validates a specific interpretation or make the cases more palatable to orthodox science. Which ultimately implies leaving on the cutting floor a treasure trove of important material often referred to as high strangeness, a whitewashing strategy that was heavily opposed by the late researcher Carla Turner, who thought it is precisely in the absurdity of high strangeness that we could start perceiving a method to the madness. It bears mentioning that focusing on the things that refuse to align with our neat little models of the universe is the most effective way to elicit a true paradigm change, if not necessarily the easiest. In the history of science, we find the example of Johannes Kepler, who was only able to establish the elliptical orbits of the planets after begrudgingly heeding Tycho Brahe's advice to pay special attention in the retrograde motion of Mars. In doing so, he was forced to throw away his entire initial theory. Ouch. But ended up giving birth to modern astronomy as we currently know it. Yay! It is this taboo material of high strangeness, only shared in hushed tones among trusted friends or fellow experiencers behind closed doors, that Mike Clellan was compelled to deep dive into with his blog 10 years ago, not even knowing if he would ever strike bottom or hold his breath long enough. I'm not exactly sure when I started following Hidden Experience, but I know exactly how I became one of its regular followers. Greg Bishop, who is one of my best friends and mentors in the UFO field, wrote about Mike on the now-defunct website UFO Mystic, where he was one of the contributors along with Nick Redfern. Greg was very close to the late McTonis, who found Mike's journal entries almost from the beginning. So it's easy to conclude Mac was the one who enthusiastically advised Greg to check out this new blog. Greg recently told me that he liked Mike's content from the start, because it was, quote-unquote, firmly in the Striever tradition. As an avid reader and commenter in UFO Mystic and other paranormal sites, I followed Greg's recommendation to visit Hidden Experience, and found out he was right. Mike was following Whitley Strieber's mantra of living with the uncertainty of what had happened to him, and refusing to simply accept the narratives imposed by investigators like Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs. I confess, Mike's strict agnosticism toward his own story was at times frustrating, and I'm sure I'm not the only reader who fantasized about giving that big bald head of his a good slap while yelling, "Snap out of it and just admit it already." I guess the universe did the same in the end, using owls instead. Yet in retrospect, I'm so ever thankful he soldiered on with his approach, and also that to this day, he still finds the terms abductee and experiencer as incapable to fully encapsulate the totality of what he's been going through, as a glass of water is an ill-suited representation of the ocean. But there was also something else which I still can't put my finger on that made Mike's story so compelling to me on a personal level. Perhaps it was the disarming honesty about his own doubts and the willingness to share his life with such openness on a public space to the point that Hidden Experience almost seemed like an oxymoron. Because this dude was laying it all exposed. Major cojones, señor. Or perhaps because the central theme behind his blog posts wasn't really UFOs, but synchronicities. And at the time, I was starting to pay attention to the magical coincidences manifesting into my own life, which even seemed to have also been boosted by my increasing immersion into cyberspace. Indeed, if the ancestral I Ching should be better understood as a quote-unquote uncertainty engine rather than a divination system, as was proposed by philosopher Will Buckingham on an Aeon essay published in 2013, then perhaps the World Wide Web should also be perceived as a living synchronicity engine, rather than an electronic communications network. An acknowledgement that would resonate with Dr. Jacques Vallée's theories that ours is an associative universe governed by consciousness and information, rather than a causative one governed by reductionist physics. Or maybe it was simply because Mike wasn't pretending to have the answers to life, the universe, and everything, but merely chronicling his bizarre memories as faithfully as was humanly possible, offering an honest lens into the life of a person who was going through events that seemed masterfully designed to challenge his concept of reality in ways that were as both subtle as they were confounding, without claiming to have any sort of guidance to anyone who might be going through the same ordeal as he was, other than opening yourself completely to the mystery. The anti-guru, if you will. Certainly a breath of fresh air in a field in which looking for a leader is a big temptation. Right, Dr. Steven? Whatever the case, I was hooked on Hidden Experience, baby. I checked on the blog every day to see if there were any updates and to also comment and read the feedback left by other people. Ah, the good old days before Facebook killed the blog star. Turns out, I wasn't the only one who felt mysteriously drawn to Mike's serialized saga. And the small flock of readers, see what I did there, eventually turn into legion after the Google Oracle associated Hidden Experience as the go-to place to find UFOs in conjunction with owls. With Mike's inclusion of wonderful artwork and maps to illustrate his posts, it sometimes felt as if we were taking part of a virtual 4D session of Dungeons & Dragons, and we're all desperately trying to keep the paladin Sir Clelin safe from the claws of the Demogorgon on his quest for the Grail. And yeah, sometimes we wanted to shove him into that creepy dark cave just to see once and for all what was lurking inside. Seriously though, what I really think was going on is that Mike's intention of using his online journal as a self-therapy tool was not only spot on, but was also working on us, the readers, as well. Hermeneutics is a branch of philosophy dealing with finding the hidden meaning of things. The word itself is derived from Hermes, Greek god of secrets and expensive ties. And in the book The Supernatural, co-written with Whitley Strieber, Professor Jeffrey Kripal argues that the very act of interpreting a hidden symbol, say an owl or a UFO, transforms the interpreter itself. The cipher becomes the catalyst. You see, if Carl Jung were alive today, I honestly believe that he too would have resorted to blogging instead of creating that mammoth illuminated manuscript called The Red Book to deal with his personal, mental, and spiritual crisis. Because in the end, that is probably what this is all about. And just like I agree with Mike that synchronicities are the universe's method to make you stop and pay attention, I also suspect that when it comes to the paranormal, nothing occurs by mere chance. By that I mean you should probably ponder on the possibility that it's no accident you happen to have this audiobook on the electronic gadget of your choice right now, dear listener. Hey, was that an owl that just hooted near your window right this moment? Any psychology undergrad is familiar with Maslow's pyramid of human motivation, which shows the primal physiological needs at the base and climbs up until it apexes with self-actualization and the person's need to realize their own potential. What few people know is that not long before he died, Maslow revised his diagram, and on top of self-actualization, he included self-transcendence. Writing about it for the website Big Think, Robbie Berman explains that we can understand that final developmental step as the need to, quote, see ourselves as part of a bigger universe to develop the common priorities that can allow humankind to survive as a species, end quote. We could also use a less pompous term and simply understand it as having a, quote-unquote, sense of a mission, just like Mike and others like him claim, in which case, even someone who may be on the fence about his story could still see the positive benefits of his ongoing introspective examination. Or maybe the urgency Mike felt when he started to type on his computer screen in the spur of the moment in March of 2009, had some deeper ulterior motive that we are yet to fathom. In which case, I'm only 73% joking when I say that I hope that by recording this foreword, Mike can put in a good word for me when the mothership lands. Red Pill Junkie, recorded in Mexico City, January 2020.
Hey, this is Mike, and I am offering up a final goodbye for this episode, a show I have truly enjoyed. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.